For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's October 31st. We're in Treyaser and Hoshea, or Perek Dalet, Chapter 4. Here, Hoshea is going to get back to giving Musar to Klal Yisrael. This is a packed Perek. It's not a story. It's going to be various forms of Musar, and each Pasuk has a significant amount to discuss. Shimu Dvar Hashem B'nai Yisrael, listen to the word of Hashem B'nai Yisrael. Ki riv la Hashem im yoshvei ha'aretz, for Hashem has a riv, a fight, with those who dwell in the land. Ki ein emes ve'ein chesed ve'ein da'as elokim ba'aretz. There is no emes, truth, there is no chesed, kindness, and no da'as elokim, no knowledge of Hashem in the land. Emes, chesed, and da'as elokim, those are the three things that Hashem is pointing out, or the Navi is pointing out, that people are lacking. If there's no emes, that means there is sheker. If there's no chesed, that means that there is the opposite of chesed, which would be either stinginess or self-centeredness. And no da'as elokim, which would mean that people are not thinking about Hashem, they're thinking about this world, themselves, etc. The Chazal tell us that, Chazal say that what is more important is Maisa, action, more important, or is limud, learning, more important? And the Gemara says that limud is maybe lidei maisa, that limud brings to maisa. When one learns what to do, learns the Torah, then what that brings to maisa, to action. This pasuk is brought as an example where Hashem is specifically zeroing in on the lack of limud, the lack of learning, because Emes, Chesed, and Das Elokim, it seems that Chazal are understanding that when it says Emes and Chesed over here, it is referring to Emes and Chesed in the context of Das Elokim, in the context of knowing Hashem. Knowing Hashem, we know that through the Torah. That's how we have Das Elokim. And when Klal Yisrael does not focus on Torah, then everything else falls apart. So the specific Musar is on that. Now the next pasuk Beis, Alo v'chachesh v'ratzoach v'ganov v'na'of. This is the result of no Torah. When there's no Torah, there is Alo. So Alo can mean taking false oaths, taking a shvua. V'chachesh, and lying. Ratzoach, murder. Ganov, stealing. Na'of, adultery. These are all the things that are results. People do all these things when there is no Das Elokim. Paratsu, they've run wild with these things. Vidamim bidamim nago, and blood in blood they touch. The Gemara uses this pasuk, damim bidamim nago, is brought the famous and terrible tragic story which we learned about in Malachim, and we read about in the Kinos on Tisha B'Av with the blood of Zechariah Hanavi. That Zechariah was killed. He was a Kohen and a Navi, and he was killed in the Beis HaMikdash in the days of Yehoash, going way, way back. And the blood did not. They couldn't wipe it away. It didn't then get absorbed. It didn't dry up. It just sat and it boiled for hundreds of years. And then later in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, when Nebuzradan came to take the Jews into Galus, he found the blood, and the famous story where he asked, "What is this blood?" And they told him, "It's the blood of animals." And he tested it. He slaughtered animals near that blood, and the blood didn't match. And finally, he threatened them with torture, and they admitted that it was a Navi that had been killed. And he took it upon himself to get kapara for the blood of Zechariah. And he then set about killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people. The Kohanim, the leaders, and then everybody else. He just killed thousands and thousands of people in order to be mechaper for the blood of Zechariah. Eventually, there was so much blood, the Gemara says, it ran like rivers in Yerushalayim. It was so bad. And it says that the damim bedamim nago, the blood of all the people that were slaughtered, touched the blood of Zechariah. That the two bloods, they came in contact with each other. At which point, Nebuzradan called out to Shamayim, and he said that I've killed the best of them. Do you want me to wipe out everybody else too? And then the blood stopped boiling. Nebuzradan himself was so inspired. I mean, or scared by what happened. And he said, Akal v'chomer, he said, if this is what happened for the blood of one Jew, imagine what's going to happen to me for all the thousands of Jews that I killed. And therefore, he ran away and actually ended up becoming a ger. But this pasuk is used. Now, this is important because damim bedamim nago, therefore, according to Chazal, is referring to murder, which makes sense. Usually when you speak about blood, you're talking about spilled blood. However, Chazal say over here as well that in the context of this pasuk, since the last avera mentioned is na'of, is adultery, and paratsu from the language of pritzus, so the Chazal say, and this is what Targum Yonason says, that damim bedam nago means sin upon sin, that it's the averos multiply and they build on each other, and it is referring to, as the Targum says, umoldin benin minesheich avrehon, that they have children from the wives of other people. With adultery, they create mamzerim. And in the creating of the mamzerim, that is called damim bedamim nago, because one avera piles upon the other averos. As they continue to do averos, they actually bring into the world mamzerim, and those mamzerim, the Gemara says that a mu'uvas lo yuchal liskon, something which is crooked and cannot be fixed, is someone who creates a mamzer, because a mamzer is permanent. Once a person is born, that's it. There's nothing can be done about it. A person can do tshuva for the avera, but the effect of the avera, the fact that an illegitimate child was brought into the world, cannot be changed. So that is a crooked thing that cannot be fixed, and that's damim bedamim nagau. It is not coincidental that the same phrase that refers to murder, damim bedamim nagau, also refers to bringing life into the world that should not have been brought into the world. We know that Ritzicha is one of the three most terrible averos. Ritzicha is a terrible thing. And we know that we value Chayim, life, we place it on a pedestal higher than most other things. As we know that most mitzvahs in the Torah are set aside because of pikuach nefashos, including Shabbos, including kashrus, things that are very dear to us. We know that if it comes to a person's life, that the life takes preference over the mitzvah. Because v'chai bohem v'lo she'omus bohem, Hashem wants us to live within the Torah and not to be killed within the Torah for most things. So murder is a particularly terrible avera. Bringing into the world life that should not have been brought into the world. So there, bringing life into the world is the opposite of murder. Usually, bringing life into the world would be a tikkun. That would be a way of correcting the avera of ritzicha, of murder. But bringing life into the world that is not meant to be brought into the world, and that's through illicit relationships, particularly adultery, so that is not a tikkun for murder. That is on the same level as murder. The same avera, how bad it is to take a life, it is just as bad to bring a life into this world that was not meant to be brought into this world. We're talking about when it's done on purpose. Just as with murder, we're talking about when it's done on purpose. And so we know that of the gimel chamuros, of the three most terrible averos, we know that besides avodah zarah, which is a rejection of Hashem himself, the other two are ritzicha, murder, and Gilui Arayos, and illicit relationships. So by doing this, by bringing this life into the world, so where you normally it should be a tikkun for Ritzicha, instead in this context, it is just as bad as Ritzicha. And therefore the same damim bedamim nago refers to murder and refers to the results of niuf, of adultery, bringing someone into the world that should not have been brought into the world. Yeah.
So to say that of the parents is one thing, but what about this child?
That's a good question. That's beyond the scope of this particular shir, but that's something to discuss within the context of mamzer, right? But the fact is that the avera is there, right?
Did Moshe have a child with the adulteress? Because you said last week that
in the first parak he had three children from the one that he married.
So he also committed adultery.
No, because she wasn't married to somebody else.
So why is she called an adulteress?
Because she was willing to go to many men. Your English says adulteress. It doesn't say adulteress. It says here a prostitute. Right.
But doesn't that make her married?
No, it doesn't make her married. It makes her a sinner, but it doesn't make her married. But even worse, Pasuk Gimel, Al Kain Tav Al Haaretz, therefore the land will be put into mourning, V'umlal Kol Yoshev Ba, and all who dwell in it will be in pain, I guess. B'chayas HaSadeh U'va'ov HaShamayim, with the beasts of the field and with the birds of the sky, V'gam Digei Hayom Ye'asefu, and also the fish of the sea will be gathered in, which means they'll be destroyed. The Gemara says that the way they were behaving was worse than the Dor HaMabul, worse than the generation of the Great Flood. Because the Dor HaMabul, everybody was killed, and all living creatures were killed, all animals, all birds, but not the fish. The fish were not killed in the Mabul. The fish survived. Here, it says that because of their behavior, not only will they be destroyed along with the animals and the birds, but also the fish of the sea will be destroyed as well. So their behavior was worse than the behavior of the Dor HaMabul. Now we know Hashem is not going to destroy the world, as He promised after the Mabul, but this means that they deserve this. That's how bad the behavior was, that it would deserve them and all of the living creatures, including fish, to be destroyed because of what they're doing. Pasuk Dalet, Ach Ish Al Yarev Va'al Yochach Ish. And however, a man will not fight, a man will not give any mussar, any admonishment. Ve'amcha Kimrive Kohen, and your nation is like the fighting of a Kohen. The Pasuk here means that they stopped the Nevi'im from giving them mussar. The Nevi'im, like Hoshea, were told to give them to criticize them for their behavior, but they would not permit the Nevi'im to say anything. So no man would fight, means no man would argue with them, no man would give them mussar, because they would be threatened, they wouldn't be allowed to speak. And your nation is like the fighting of the Kohen. This V'amcha Kimrivei Kohen is quoted in Gemara in a couple of different places to tell us that Kohanim were known for their short temper. This is something the Gemara says in several places, even though the Kohanim are the descendants of Aaron HaKohen, who is a Rodev Shalom, an Oev Shalom, a Rodev Shalom, so he stands for peace. However, the Kohanim also are known for that in situations that call for a strong response, then they can also be known for a shorter fuse, for reacting more quickly than others would react. Normally, that is used by Kohanim in a positive manner, as we find with Levi and the Egel Hazav, with the golden calf, that they were the ones who stood up when Moshe called for them, and they were willing to fight for Hashem. And also, we find that with Hanukkah, that the Hashmonaim are the ones who stand up and fight for Hashem. So normally, what it means is the Kohanim, when called upon, can be more quick to react in a tough manner when that is the thing that's called for. However, like all good midos, it can also be used in the negative. And therefore, the Gemara says that this is, for example, one of the reasons for the concept of a get makushar, What is a get makushar? We don't do it today. It's not used today. But a get makushar is as follows. We know that in order for a Jewish man and woman to get divorced, so the man has to give his wife a get. So a get is a document. It's written up and it's signed and it is given to from the husband to the wife. The normally, if a man should divorce his wife, as long as she has not yet remarried, he is allowed to take her back. He's allowed to remarry her. The couple can become remarried as long as she has not married anybody else. Once she marries somebody else, even if later she is widowed or divorced from that second husband, she cannot go back to the first husband. That's called machzir grushaso. That's taking back the woman he divorced after she married somebody else. That is prohibited. But as long as she has never married anybody else, the first husband can marry her again. With the exception of a kohen, because we know a kohen cannot marry a grusha. Kohen cannot marry a divorcee. That's true even if it's his own divorcee. Once a kohen divorces his wife, she is off limits to him forever. Therefore, it is Chazal wanted to put in place a safeguard to make a kohen think twice before divorcing his wife. Everybody should think twice before going through a divorce, but with a kohen, it's even more so because it cannot be reversed. This is exacerbated by this pasuk of kimirivei kohen, because a kohen might react very strongly, very quickly. And so not only can it not be reversed, he may react with a divorce more quickly than a non-kohen. So it was necessary for Chazal to come up with a mechanism to delay the kohen. So the way they did this is they instituted a get makushar. A get makushar works as follows. As I said, a get is a document. That's all it is. It's written at the time of the divorce, and it's given from the husband to the wife. The document's on one page. So picture a ksuba. It's like ksuba is a document. This is a document. That's all it is. So normally, a document is written, and at the bottom of the document, two kosher witnesses sign it. Just like in a ksuba, two kosher witnesses sign it. Also a get, two kosher witnesses sign the get. That's what's necessary. For a kohen, what they did is they said as follows. They were writing not on paper, but on parchment, so it had more substance to it. So what they did is they would write one line. A get has 12 lines. They would write one line, then they would fold the page down. So, let's say they'd write one line up here. After they wrote that line, they would take the page and they would fold it over. Oh, take paper, that's good. Thank you. Okay. So they'd write the first line. Then they would fold it over. So now you only have a blank space. You can't see what's written underneath it. They would sew that fold down. Then they would have a witness sign just that fold. Then they'd write a second line. So when they wrote a second line, they would now fold it again. Let's see if we can figure out how to do it. They would do it like this. Right, accordion fashion. So the second line would be written, the first line is written here, the second line would be written down here. They would fold that down. This is already folded down. They would sew it again. And a witness would sign the second fold. And so forth. They would keep doing that until they had 12, it's always complicated. You learn the Gemara to figure out how this works. But it's something like this. Then you would end up with 12 folds all the way down the paper. It would look like a fan. And in doing that, it would delay the process significantly. That's called a get makushar. Literally, makushar means tied. Here it really means sewn up. Get. And it would be a much more tedious process, sewing, writing, sewing, signing, writing, sewing, signing, writing, sewing, signing, and it would delay everything, and the hope would be that if the Kohen would give it a second thought, perhaps they would not go through with it. That's the reason. But this pasuk of Kimirive Kohen is part of the reason for that Get Mekusher institution. As I said, it's not done today, but that is discussed in the Gemara actually pretty extensively.
Why did they stop doing it?
I'm not sure. I don't know why they stopped doing it.
Or when?
I don't know that either.
Okay.
It's a good question. I don't know. Pasuk K, verse 5. V'chashalta hayom, and you will stumble today. V'chashal gam navi imcha laila, and the navi will also stumble with you at night. V'damisi imecha. And your mother, which is referring to the Jews as a whole, Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people as a whole, are sometimes called the mother of the Jewish people. We had that earlier in Hosea, that Klal Yisrael as a whole were called the mother. So, V'dami Simecha, your mother will be, I believe that means shamed. I think it's what it means.
It says silenced.
Silenced.
I will silence your mother.
Okay, silenced. Okay, here it says cut off in Mitzvahs. Okay, so what does it mean, you'll stumble today, and the Navi with you will stumble at night? We're going to here have a series of psukim that single out the leadership of the Jewish people. So the first question is, if there is one of the leaders of the Jewish people needs to be punished, needs to be admonished, how should it be done? There's two schools of thought. You could argue that if Hashem is going to punish a leader of the Jewish people, it should be done publicly, because since the leader is a public figure, if the leader is misbehaving, then it should be done in a way that everybody sees the punishment. On the other hand, you could argue that if the leader is punished publicly, it is a greater chilul Hashem. Since the leader represents the people and therefore represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it becomes a greater Chil Hashem. So this pasuk is saying that what Hashem does typically is the second way, that even though He may punish others in Hayom during the day, in a way that people see it, but the Navi, which is one of the leaders, if they need to be punished, they will be punished at night to avoid the Chil Hashem, that it should not be done publicly. So in that way, the leader is treated, let's say, less harshly, because the problem is that if it's done publicly, it creates a chilul Hashem. However, the next pasuk vav, nidmu ami mibli adas, my nation has become ignorant, without knowledge. Because you have rejected das, knowledge. How do you read this? Ve em ascha mikahein li, and I have therefore rejected you from being a kohen to me. Vatishkach toras elokecha, you have forgotten the Torah of your God. Eshkach banecha gam ani, I will also forget your children. So, continuing from the previous pasuk, Chazal explained that this pasuk is referring specifically to the leadership, and the leadership is taken to task for the ignorance that is found in the people. Since it's the leadership's job to educate the people, if they are not doing that, then they are held responsible for the ignorance of everybody else, and even worse, if the Talmud Chacham begins to forget his Torah because he neglects it, he does not put in the appropriate time to his learning, and therefore begins to forget his Torah, so Hashem says, Eshkach banecha gamani, then I will also forget your children. If you forget my Torah, then I will forget your children. The Talmud Chacham is tasked with the responsibility of the stewardship of the Torah, and that means that he himself must remain a scholar. He must remain an expert in the areas of the Torah. He has to know it. And he's held responsible to make sure that it is available to be taught to everybody else. And if that doesn't happen, it is the Talmud Chacham and the leadership that is held accountable.
Okay, I understand them being held accountable, but it says that everyone's going to die along with the animals, the birds, and the fish, which would mean that the ones that are like a tinok, because they didn't know, are being punished right along with those who
should have
thought
that. Yeah, okay, we're not getting into, I mean, it doesn't say that over here. It just says that it seems like it's talking to the people who did the averos. There are times when Hashem, as we know, will destroy everything, even those who never did anything wrong. That, you know, that's already a philosophical question, which again is really beyond this. But it didn't say that here. Here it just was talking to the people who did the averos.
All right, but so, Hosea is allowed to tell them this, even though they said that Navis, they wouldn't listen to Navis in the past?
He was told to tell them. I mean, you know, hopefully he'll listen. I mean, that's, Hashem sent many Nevi'im to Klal Yisrael. And unfortunately, we frequently didn't listen, which is why Yonah didn't want to talk to Nineveh, right? Because it looked bad. So this was unfortunately what happened throughout that thousand-year period of Nevuah. That was a common issue. Now, it doesn't mean we never listened, but there were many times that we didn't. Pasuk Zayin. Kirubam kein chatuli. Kivodam b'kolon amir. Now, simple meaning here is kirubam, as they matured, as they got older, as they increased, there were more and more Jews. Kein chatuli, so too their sins increased. Kivodam, so therefore their honor, bekalon amir, in shame I will exchange it. I'll exchange their honor for shame, because the more Jews there were, the more that they sinned. Here again, Chazal focus on the leadership. Kirubam, from the word rav, from their leadership, kein chatuli, that's why everybody else sinned. Because the leadership sinned, therefore everybody else sinned. And the Medrash here illustrates this. It says, the Nasi did something that was inappropriate. So when the Nasi did something inappropriate, the Av Bezdin said, well, if the Nasi can do it, I can do it too. Then the Av Bezdin, once he did it, so then the rest of the Sanhedrin said, well, if the Av Bezdin did it, then I can do it. And then it, you know, and then Medrash just follows it down the line that each successive person says, well, if the other person did it, then there's nothing wrong with me doing it. Speaking to the responsibility of the leadership to set a good example, and when they don't, God forbid, then they are held accountable for everybody else. Pasuk Ches. Chatas ami ochelu velavonam yisu nafsho. What was going on in the days of Hosea, as we'll see in a few psukim, this is primarily directed at the northern kingdom, at Malchus Yisrael. What they had done is they had replaced the real Kohanim with people who weren't supposed to be Kohanim. Those who were not supposed to be Kohanim, so they were acting as if they were the ones who were processing Karbonos. Now, we've never discussed this, and I don't know if anybody's thought this through, but if you think about it, the Kohanim are direct beneficiaries of the Karbonos of the Jewish people. When a person brings a Karbon, except for an Ola, which is completely burned, a Kohen gets at least part of the animal to eat, part of the carbon to eat. So the Kohen is the direct beneficiary. Whoever's working at that time in the Beis HaMikdash benefits from whatever is brought to the Beis HaMikdash. So what that means is the more Karbonos brought, the more the Kohanim have. So if it's a slow time in the Beis HaMikdash, or a slow time in wherever they're bringing their Karbonos, because the northern kingdom, they would bring the Karbonos to other places, not necessarily to the Beis HaMikdash, but wherever it was being in Beis El, wherever they were having it at Mizbeach, if it's a slow time for a Karbonos, so how do you get people to bring Karbonos?
Make up stuff.
Well, you can make up stuff.
Sin.
If you make them sin. If they do Averos, they have to bring more Karbonos, because you have to bring a sin offering, a Chatas, for doing an Avera. The more Averas that are done, the Kohanim benefit. They end up with more Karbonos. So here,
can't you do it for Todah though too?
Yeah, they could. They could. But they're not compelled to. For a sin, you're compelled to bring a Karbon. So Chatas Amiyochelu, they would consume the sins of my nation. Literally the sins. Meaning that because of the sins, they would have to bring Karbonos, which made these fake Kohanim happy. Ve'avonam yisunav sho. And for their sins, they lift their souls. They're happy. They're thrilled that there's more sins so they can have more karbanos.
Are they fake because somebody put them in that position, or are they fake because of the adultery that they're not really the Kohen?
Yeah, that's a good question. It seems that they pushed out the Kohanim. Because remember, it wasn't the Beis HaMikdash. It was Beis El, whatever it is, the Kohane Beis El they're called. They weren't really Kohanim. That's what it seems. But it could be right also. It could be because we lost track of who was who. You know. Yeah.
How do one know when the leaders are not correct?
Yeah, it's a scary thing, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah. We count on the leadership to show us the way, so if they're not correct, then where does that leave us? Right. So that is what is being said over here for why they're being held accountable. We say that lo alman Yisrael, the Jews are never left without proper leadership. Hashem always provides us with some proper leadership, but sometimes there's conflicting leadership. And that's where it becomes the responsibility of the rest of us to figure out who is authentic and who is not. So if the entire leadership is corrupt, then we really have, what are we supposed to do? There's no way for us to discern right from wrong, because we're looking at the leadership and they're all corrupt. But if there are those who are authentic and those who are corrupt, then we do have a responsibility to asay l'charav, to choose the authentic one and not the corrupt ones. That does fall to the people. That can be somewhat challenging. At the same time, the Gemara tells us that a generation gets the leadership it deserves. Now that doesn't mean that everybody's going to get corrupt leadership, but it does mean that the level of leadership, because there's better and worse. We know the Gemara tells us, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro, that Shmuel Hanavi was one of the greatest Nevi'im ever, when he was the leader, so you had to follow him. When Yiftach, who was also a leader, but far below the level of Shmuel, when he was the leader, we had to follow him. The generation got what it deserved. In Yiftach's generation, they didn't deserve having Shmuel. So they got Yiftach. In Shmuel's generation, they deserved to have Shmuel. So the leader also reflects on the people who he is leading. So it cuts both ways. Pasuk Tes. V'hayacham ka-kohen, and the nation will be treated like the Kohen, which Rashi explains means that just as the Kohen was replaced by non-Kohanim, so Hashem says, I'll treat the nation that way. I won't treat them as special. Ufakarati alav derachav, and I will visit upon them their ways. Umal alav ashivlo, and their bad behavior I will return to them. I'll do bad to them. What does that mean? Va'achlu v'lo yisbo, they will eat and they will not be satiated. His new v'lo yifrotsu, they will they have done. His new means they've done znus. They've been promiscuous and they will not yifrotsu. They will not multiply. They won't have a lot of children. Kis Hashem azavu lishmor, for they have forsaken Hashem from guarding His ways. They are not doing Hashem's ways. I'm going to come back to this in a moment. Let me read one more pasuk. Znus v'yayin v'sirosh yikach lev. Znus, promiscuity. Yayin v'sirosh, which means wine, yikach lev, will take away the heart. The people in the northern kingdom, this theme is mentioned several places in Tanakh. In Malchus Yisrael, they were very enamored with good wine, and the drinking of wine led them astray. As we know, wine is a very powerful force. It is used in all of our important ceremonies. We have it with Kiddush, we have it with a wedding, we have it at a bris, a pidyon haben. What's that?
Havdalah.
Right? We do it. We use wine everywhere. Wine is considered a way of marking something as being special. But at the same time, wine can easily corrupt. Wine can be used as a very bad tool that can hurt a person and hurt a lot of people. So the wine that they were so involved with led to znus, it led to promiscuity, which ended up taking them away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Going back to Pasuk Yud, verse 10, his new v'lo yifrotsu. So here Chazal say an important thing. The hiznu means to act in a promiscuous way. Promiscuity can mean relationships that are prohibited. That's what it can mean. And that would include not only adultery and incest, but other types of inappropriate relationships. Obviously, same-gender relationships would be included in that. But besides that, even physical relationships that are out of wedlock would be included in his new in acting in a promiscuous manner, which is, of course, prohibited. The Chazal tell us here on this pasuk, his new v'lo yifrotsu. So the literal translation is what we said, as a punishment for acting promiscuously, therefore they will not merit yifrotsu, they will not merit having a lot of offspring. But Chazal turned the pasuk around as well, and they say, a relationship that is not meant to produce offspring is considered in a certain way a promiscuous relationship. Now what that means, which is a scathing thing to say, but that means is that even a husband and wife who are married appropriately, but if they are not involved in procreation, so they're not out to create offspring, then that relationship in a certain way is compared to a promiscuous relationship, because the purpose of it is not to bring children into the world. Now, this does not mean that a husband and wife are required to always be attempting to bring children into the world. That is not so, and there are many situations in which contraception is permissible. But what it means is the overall attitude of the husband and wife needs to be that our goal is to bring the next generation into the world. How many, how often, etc. That's an individual question which every couple needs to work out, hopefully with proper mentorship. But the general attitude has to be one that we are marrying so that we can create a bias, a household. That's the purpose of the marriage, is to create the next generation. We're not marrying for our own selfish needs, but rather we're marrying for the purpose of bringing the next generation to the world. Otherwise, it is considered a selfish relationship and is considered to be a promiscuous relationship. Again, this is a generality. There are situations in which couples are not able to, for whatever reason, or for whatever reason they are not, they need to not do so at this time. Whatever it is, we're not talking about the specific reasons why sometimes it is necessary for couples to not bring children into the world. But as a general attitude, the attitude has to be, we are marrying so that we can bring the next generation into the world.
So if there's a couple that's selfish, and Hashem now is saying, I'm not going to give you a lot of children, but they didn't want children, so how's that a punishment?
Right, so that's a drasha, meaning the simple meaning is, because people are promiscuous, then even if they want to bring children into the world, they will not be able to. Chazal, the one saying that we're going to read it the other way around, that because of not wanting to bring children into the world, therefore it is promiscuous. They're reading it backwards. But that's not the simple meaning of the pasuk. That's a reversal reading of the pasuk. Okay, and finally, the last pasuk we're going to do tonight, as you will see, this one will. One second. No, I'm sorry. Two more pasukim. Two more tonight. Ami, I hope we get to pasuk Yud Gimel. Let's see. Yud Beis 12. Ami be'etzo yishol, my nation will ask their eights, and eights of course means a tree. This is referring to idolatry, that they will ask the eights, they'll ask the wood for what to do. They'll ask for direction. Umaklo yagidlo, and his stick, his staff, will tell him what to do. Again, is a form of divining, using a staff or a stick and seeing how it falls down or seeing what it does as a way of knowing, of deciding what to do in the future. So all of that is forms of either idolatry or sorcery or something like that. Ki ruach zinunim hisa, for a spirit of promiscuity has led them astray. Vayiznu itachas elokehem, and they have gone astray from their God. This, as we mentioned before, the metaphor of znus, of adultery, is used when talking about avodah zara, of idolatry. Because idolatry in the relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where we are compared to the woman, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu kivyachol is compared to the man in the relationship, when the Jews go to idolatry, then it is like the woman going to another man, and therefore the metaphor of adultery for idolatry. So here in this pasuk, those two things are compared to each other. Chazal say over here,
yeah. The stick and the stone, they're not compared to nations. These are not specific nations that are used to hurt the Jewish people.
Sometimes we do find that a stick or a staff is referring to those that are brought to punish the Jewish people. But here it doesn't say it in the form of punishment. Here it says in the form of that they'll ask direction from the Sotz Avodah Zarah. Chazal say over here a fascinating thing. All right, we'll see how long this next piece takes us. The halacha is that one is when there is a. Let me start this conversation over again. It's not a conversation because I'm lecturing, but I'm going to start it over again. There's a concept out there that people call, different names for it, rabbi shopping, or maybe kula shopping, looking for a leniency. I have a question. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this and this on Shabbos. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to eat this and this food. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this in this business practice, but I want to be permitted. Everybody wants a kula. Everybody wants a leniency. Nobody wants to be machmir. They don't want to be stringent. They want to be able to do what they want to do. So I want to be selective in who I ask my shilas to. Because if I go to that rabbi might be tell me I can't do it. And that rabbi might tell me I can't do it. I want to go to one who says I can do it. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask several rabbis until one of them tells me it's okay. And that way, I'll get my green light. So we all know that's a no-no. You're not allowed to do that. You can't go from rabbi to rabbi. You ask a question, then you get the answer, and you're expected, we are all expected, to follow the psak halacha that we get from whoever we ask. Okay, we have the right to ask whomever we wish, but once we ask, we're expected to follow it. So that's once we ask. But sometimes you can have different rabbis that develop different reputations for different things. So you can have the rabbi that is known to be lenient when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, and the other rabbi is known to be lenient when it comes to Kashrus, and the other one is known to be lenient when it comes to Taras HaMishpacha. So we're certainly tempted, if rabbis develop a reputation like that, it's certainly tempting to go to the one that is going to give me the answer that I'm looking for. So is it permitted for me to go from one to the other, depending on the question? That's a general question out there. There are tshuvas written about this. So are you allowed to do that? So there's a gemara. The gemara says that when you have a dispute between two, it's talking there about two sages of the Mishnah, but this would be true about any two equal rabbis or poskim. So the Braisa says you can do the kulos and chumros, the leniencies and the stringencies of one of them or of the other one. But if a person does, the Gemara says he should not do the stringencies of both nor the leniencies of both. The Gemara says if he does the stringencies of both, then the Gemara says, on this the Pasuk says, v'hakesil b'choshech holeich, the fool goes in darkness. He's considered a fool if he follows the stringencies of everybody. And if he follows the kulas of everybody, the leniencies of everybody, then the Gemara says he's called a rasha. He's called an evil person. That is a no-no, to follow the leniencies of everybody. However, as the Gemara discusses this in Maseches Erevin, the Gemara's conclusion is this is only true when the two rulings, the two stringencies or the two leniencies, are self-contradictory. When they're self-contradictory, then it would be a person would be a rasha to take both leniencies and would be a ksil, a fool, to take both stringencies. What's an example of something where where it's self-contradictory? So I'll give you an example which is not one that would apply to us, but it's an example in the Gemara and it brings out the point. And anyway, it's an interesting thing. You know that Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah for
trees.
What does that mean? That is the Rosh Hashanah for trees. That's a halachic date. So halacha for what? What difference does it make when the Rosh Hashanah is for trees?
How old they are.
For?
How old they are.
How old they are for?
Orla.
For Orla. Okay.
The fruit that they have
to be. Okay. So it matters what year the tree is. So the Gemara there is not discussing Orla. The Gemara is discussing their Meiser, which would be as follows. We've talked about this before, that in the 7-year Shemitah cycle, so in the first and second years of the Shemitah cycle, when one grows things in Eretz Yisrael, one takes off 2 maisros, tithes twice. Maiser Rishon, that is given to the Levi, and Maiser Sheni, a second tithe. That Maiser Sheni is kept by the farmer and brought to Yerushalayim and eaten in Yerushalayim. That's Maiser Sheni. That's in the first 2 years. Both of those Maisros, both tithings, are done each of the first 2 years. In the third year, there's also 2 Maisros, but it's not the same thing. In the third year, the Maiser Rishon, the first Maiser that goes to the Levi, that is maintained. But the second Maiser is not Maiser Sheni that's brought to Yerushalayim and eaten in Yerushalayim, but rather it is replaced by Maiser Ani, with a tithe that goes to the poor. That happens in the third year. So if one is growing a tree, and it is the second year of the tree, then one would take off Maiser Rishon, give that to the Levi, and Maiser Sheni, which they would keep for themselves and take to Yerushalayim and eat in Yerushalayim. But if it's the third year, then they would take off Maiser Rishon and give that to the Levi, and then they would take off Maiser Ani and give that to the poor. So it matters what year of the tree, what year of the Shemitah cycle it is. Not what year of the tree, but what year of the Shemitah cycle it is. And for the trees, even though the Shemitah cycle begins and ends with our Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Tishrei, but for the trees, what matters is that which is picked before or after Tu B'Shvat. If it is harvested before Tu B'Shvat, it's the previous year. Now, let's, for our sake, say the second year. If it's harvested after Tu B'Shvat, it's the next year. It is the third year. The truth is, though, Tu B'Shvat is a machlokas, is a dispute. Beis Hillel says that Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah for trees. Beis Shammai disagrees. Anybody know when Beis Shammai says the Rosh Hashanah for trees is?
Rosh Hashanah.
The first day of Shvat. Beis Hillel says it's the 15th of Shvat, Tu B'Shvat, but Beis Shammai says it's the first day of Shvat. What happens if you pick a fruit off of a tree on the 10th day of Shvat? So according to Beis Shammai, you're now in the next year, and according to Beis Hillel, you're in the previous year. So if a person there says, I'm going to be stringent both ways, I'm going to take off both Maiser Sheni, as if it's the previous year, and Maiser Ani, as if it's the next year, that person is a fool, because that's contradictory. It can't be both. It can only be one or the other. It's either the second year or the third year. It can't be both years. So that person is a fool. If the person says, I'm going to take the leniencies of both, Beis Shammai says, I'm not required to give Maiser Sheni. Beis Hillel says, I'm not required to give Maiser Ani, so I won't give either one. That person is a Rasha. That person is evil, because that's contradictory. Person can't do that. If it is not contradictory, I'm just making sure we're okay with time, if it is not contradictory, then it is okay for a person to be stringent both ways and lenient both ways. Meaning, a person is not a fool for being stringent both ways if it's not contradictory, and a person is not a Rasha for being lenient both ways if it is not contradictory. Now, an example of not being contradictory would be, what if I'm being stringent because I'm not sure? I don't know. I'm not sure I'm not sure about something. If I don't know who to go like, I don't know if I should go like this one or that one, so I'm going to go with both of them because I don't know who's right and who's wrong, that's okay. Because that's not saying we rule this way, but I'm going to be stringent that way. That would be foolish. But rather, a person is saying, I don't know who's right and who's wrong. We don't know. Today, we're very machmir in a lot of things because we don't know. We don't know who's right and who's wrong. That's not acting like a fool. That's covering our bases because we don't know who's right and who's wrong. That's fine. The Gemara says Rabbi Akiva didn't know whether Beis Hillel held Tu B'Shvat or the first day of Shvat. Rabbi Akiva wasn't sure which one was Beis Hillel's opinion and which one was Beis Shammai's opinion. So he held both, even though they're contradictory, because he didn't know which one was Beis Hillel. That's different. That's because it's being unsure. Being unsure, one is allowed to be stringent both ways. So the Gemara tells us that, again, if it's not contradictory, you're allowed to be lenient. You're not a Rasha. You're not evil for being lenient both for all around. So that means I could go to this rabbi who's going to be lenient with Shabbos, and this rabbi is going to be lenient with Kashrus, and this rabbi is going to be lenient with Taras HaMishpacha. That's fine, because it's not, they don't contradict each other. However, the Gemara says, even though a person's not a Rasha for doing that, it's not a recommended practice. And they bring this pasuk as the source for that. Because the pasuk says, Umaklo yagidlo, which literally means, and his staff will tell him what to do. But Chazal make a play on words, and they say, Umikulo, and for his leniencies, yagidlo, that's what tells him. He looks for leniencies. It's not a good attitude for a person to constantly be looking for leniencies. I once met a person who told me, not in Atlanta, I once met a person who told me, this is what I was just surprised by how unabashedly he said this. He said, yeah, anytime I have a question, I find the most lenient opinion, and that's what I follow. That's what he said. Like, most people aren't, a lot of people do that, most people don't admit that they do that. Right? Just say, yeah, well, why shouldn't I? Like, I know there are strict opinions and lenient opinions, so he was using English books, you know, English halakha books, so he said, I find the one that has the most lenient opinion, that's what I follow. Why should I make life hard for myself? So, the Gemara says, although that person may not be a Rasha, because if they don't contradict each other, it's okay to do that, it's not a Rasha, it's not a good attitude to have. We're not here looking for leniencies. That's not how we live life. Now, we don't have to look for stringencies either. We don't have to live our lives constantly unable to do anything. But to have an attitude that I'm looking for the easy way out, I'm looking for easy street, that's not a way to grow. So, therefore, what the Gemara recommends is to stick with one rabbi. That this is my rabbi, and if he tells me to be lenient, I'll be lenient. If he tells me to be stringent, I'll be stringent. Asay lecha rav, that's the best situation, and the buck stops with that rabbi. And if the rabbi tells me that in his opinion, I should be stringent, even though I know there are others who are more lenient, and perhaps my friend is doing the leniency because they asked somebody else, but I'm going to be stringent because that's what my rabbi told me to do. And in another situation, it'll be reversed. My rabbi will be lenient and the other one will be stringent. And that's a better way to be. There are some exceptions to this. For example, let's say there is a rabbi who is known to be an expert in a particular area of halacha. So then it's not an even playing field anymore. Then my rabbi is a good rabbi. He's good for me. I feel he understands me. He understands my family. He knows where I'm coming from. I'm comfortable with my rabbi. But in this particular area of halacha, there's another rabbi who is known as an expert. A common example of this is kashrus. Kashrus is, Mrs. Stein will tell you, is a very specialized field. And if you're not in the field, most rabbis who are not in the field are really not very well equipped to deal with kashrus. I'm not talking about how to kasher something. I'm talking about products, buying products. What's you have a product in the store and it doesn't have a hechsher. Is it okay? Is it not okay? If you're not in the food business, I'm saying the halachic food business, then it's you're very hard pressed to know what to do, because it's such a complex field. Only those who are really in it can properly assess it, and so therefore it is very common that rabbis who are not in kashrus, when you have a kashrus question about products, they will recommend, please call. In our case, it would be the AKC. If other cities, other kashrus organizations, but that's because it's a specialized field, and those who are in it are greater experts than others. So in that situation, it is not just acceptable; it's actually recommended to seek out the expert. Now, a good rabbi will tell the person who's asking them that, you know, in this situation, you really need to speak to so and so. That would be a sign of a good rabbi, knowing his limitations. That would be a good thing, and that should happen. Sometimes the area of expertise is one that somebody has that you can't access easily, and perhaps your rabbi can. So then your rabbi can be invaluable in reaching out to the expert on your behalf. So that system works as well. So even though it is recommended to stick with one rabbi, Aseh Lecha Rav, but there are exceptions in situations where someone else would be reached out to. And of course, the other exception would be if your rabbi is unavailable, which happens. Someone's not available, and then you got to reach out to somebody else. So that would be another case where it could happen.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.